I have Bruce Rawls here, and this is Lynn Johnson, and we're here for the House of the Risen Sun. And so I want to say good morning to Bruce. How are you this morning? Is it cold out there?
Good morning, Lynn. Yes, it's cool. It's a little warmer this week now than the previous week or two. We actually had about almost an inch of snow the other day, which is mostly melted. I actually took my snow shovel with me from Colorado, thinking, I'll never need this. But I actually got out for about 3 or 4 minutes, shoveled the driveway. Not much to shovel, but by the time I got to it, but it was just kind of fun to say, wow, I could. You know, if I ever need it again, I've got it there. So
I didn't bring this for no reason whatsoever.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's all part of the dream script.
That's right.
Thinking that we need stuff and then making up, you know. Who was it? David Icke, was one of the reintroductions, I guess, to the idea that I'm going to paraphrase his work greatly, but there's the ego makes up, a problem and then proposes a dysfunctional solution to solving it, which I think I like Ken's broader vision a bit more, but I like Icke's idea that basically Ken's comment that he wanted to be known for, he said this is, in several of his audios, he said this is his favorite phrase that he wanted to be remembered for is that the world and the ego is a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem.
Yeah.
And I think this FAQ that I've selected, if it works for you, addresses this very nicely. So,
all right. Did you send me a link?
I did. It says 1253. Do you need me to send the link?
Just a second. Let me check.
Okay.
I can get on the right thing.
Post it again.
Okay. And. Nope, go ahead and send it again.
Okay, I just did. It's in the chat window in your Skype.
All right, let me look here. For some reason, my Skype is not...
While you're looking for it, I'll read the intro, basically the terse version of the question that appears at the top of the page, and that is, how exactly do I, quote, project, unquote, my world? So that actually,
great question.
I think it really fits beautifully, yeah. And
1253, is that the one?
At 1253, yeah.
Okay, got it, yeah.
Great, yeah. I just think this is such an important reminder, and I need it all the time. I mean, I'm sure everyone else does too, because it's so easy to forget that, you know, we're looking at a massive hologram. This is, as Richard Bach says, MGM worlds and Warner Brothers lifetimes. You know, this is
exactly
this is high theater we're looking at here.
I do see it a lot.
Yeah,
that's what I recognize my projection.
Yeah,
it's so bizarre when you recognize. Oh, I'm doing. I see this. I see this. And it's interesting. You mentioned David Icke. He's an interesting character because he has also all this conspiracy theory thing, isn't
it? Right.
Yeah, which I think is bizarre with the when he talks about the things that he talks about that are so clear and very spiritually correct, as far as I can tell. Of course, I don't know everything, and I don't know really, but then he starts up with this conspiracy theory stuff, and you're like, where does that come from? How does about in your thinking?
Yeah, I think that actually ties into nicely. I mean, obviously, it's interesting to watch how quickly we go into a blame game of about the they. who are the conspirators that are conspiring to do things we don't like, whatever that might be. But it's interesting to see how clever and insidious and how fearful our egos really are, and the myriad of forms and the countless variations of cloak and dagger and spy versus spy and all of the incredible diversity of strategies that the ego has for trying to avoid detection, elimination. Because it basically is, this maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem. part of the maladaptive stuff is it, we, you know, to generalize, as Ken Salvo suggests that we do, if we look at any specific thing in our world, including whether it's a government or a non-government agency or it's a, you know, any individual or a group of individuals or whatever that, that seem to be conspiring to, you know, mess things up for our dream world, we need to just kind of step back and remember that it is a dream. And that because of that, I mean, using that metaphor, it's not that we don't navigate through it the best we can with, you know, the most effective and kind, you know, well, it is effectively and as kindly as we can. But to remember, if we remember that it's a dream, we'll be empowered to see the world differently. We'll be able to see that if the world is the outer picturing of an inward condition, and it's really, as one of the workbook lessons suggests, it's, you know, the outer shield of oblivion that keeps us, you know, attempts to keep us mindless. That's the dysfunctional strategy of the ego, because it's only through the mind that we become free. So that's why it's, you know, a maladaptive solution, because we're never going to solve the ego's problems on the level on which the ego made them, which is on the level of mind. But that's not where we want to go most of the time. We want to identify with the bodies and the world and the forms and you know, do instead of BBB.
Exactly. Well, to look externally for the cause. Right. And that's what I see is that we're looking externally for a cause of something that is actually being generated by our own thinking. So it's the idea of blaming anyone else or thinking that there is an out there. You know, I see this in myself and with the new political regime here in America, looking and saying, oh my God, they're monsters. You know, look at this guy, has no compassion. And then, you know, like, oh, who is the monster with no compassion? Who is the one who is projecting this whole story? And recognize that it's my own thinking. And the key to the solution, if you're really, truly, truly, truly wanting to find the solution to all of this upset, you really have to go inside and look at what is my purpose for this and recognize that I'm doing it myself. And if I change my purpose, the outer will shift as well. But, you know, this is, you know, it's not even the product of a collective mind that's insane. It's a product of my mind that's insane. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I see it so clearly. And I got to thank, you know, the whole political system that I invented for coming to the point of being just so absurd that you can't help but see that it couldn't possibly be true.
Right.
So that's just my thinking. But yeah, let's look at this frequently asked question.
Okay.
So you read the question.
The top one. I didn't read the queue of the Q&A. I just read the summary, the shorter one.
Okay. So why don't you go ahead and read then? And
okay. The question 1253, and these are again from, we've been reading Lynn and I quite some time now, over a year, from the frequently asked questions of the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, FAQs. And they're just wonderful. There's about 1300 plus of them. I've been making my way more recently slowly through these, but they're all gems. I haven't found one that isn't, you know, full of things that can either be used very specifically for issues that people are, you know, dealing with, or generalized very quickly, because they start with usually specifics questions and then lead to generalizations, which, by the way, is something that I admire in the writings of Susan Dugan, who I'll put a little plug for her website, the Forays in Forgiveness website, if you want to check out all three of her books. I just finished her third book about the Course in Miracles, and really good. They're just little short essays that again, start from the specific and lead to the general. And I think that's really the a tremendously helpful approach to healing the schisms in our mind, as we take the things that seem to be outside of ourselves and then bring them back into the mind for our forgiveness classroom work to resolve the seeming differences between self and other. And then amazingly, when we get rid of that non-existent problem, there's no longer a need for the maladaptive solution, right? So the question goes, A Course in Miracles speaks often of how we have, quote, made up our world, unquote. It uses the word projection, stating that it is mind that does the seeming deed. But I am confused as to how I make up my world. How did or do I do it? And one of our resident cats, Cooper, just chimed in there, if you heard that meow.
How do I do it?
How do I make up my world, including cats? And how does Cooper make up his world, including humans, that he depends on to be fed?
The key is Cooper didn't make that up and isn't even actually there.
Exactly.
Your mind, and you are caring for a kitty in your mind.
Exactly.
Wow.
Right. But it's all part of this massive dream that there's separate selves and bodies and things that need to be done and yada yada yada.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable when you start actually recognizing yourself as the center of the universe. And I think that's how I'm just seeing myself as the center of the universe. And I had a dream. I had an experience. I just wanted to describe this real quickly. It's been several years ago, but it was pretty amazing. I had a dream, and in my dream, I was all there was. And everywhere when I would look, it was like my gaze was like a spotlight. And I was like I was in a dark place, but my gaze was like a spotlight. And everywhere I looked with my gaze, I could see the world. I could see what was directly in front of me. But I wasn't in the dark. I was in a completely light. I mean, it was just, everything was just light all around me. And so what I was actually seeing when I would look out this, just the periphery of my, my whole vision, from central to peripheral, I saw, the world. I saw the world. But I could also see that beyond that, around the edges, was where I was. And I knew that I was the light. Mm-hmm. And so the world I saw, I was projecting. And I saw that in my dream. And I woke up from the dream and the world was like that. I woke up from the dream. I got up out of bed. I carried my projection. And all I saw was what was being projected in that, from the central of my vision to the periphery, that was the entire, all that actually existed. And beyond that, I knew there was nothing but light. And, I spent like the whole morning in kind of a state of amazement to see how I actually was projecting. Now, this obviously.
Cool dream.
Yeah. Well, I was awake. That's the thing. It was a dream. And when I woke up, it was still that way. Mm-hmm. And it was that way for a good part of the morning of that day. And I was like amazed. But it faded away. But I still have that knowing. I still have very clearly the memory of that entire thing and how it came from being in a dream, a sleeping dream, to being in a waking dream, being awake.
Mm-hmm.
The state of consciousness didn't shift, and I could see very clearly that I was doing it. And, I don't call that a miracle or anything. I just see that I was given a shift that pointed out to me how it was my projection that was making the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, the experience was something. The memory is really flat. mm-hmm. compared to the actual experience.
Yeah, yeah, I totally get that, because I've had a similar dream, or probably several, but one in particular that was a projection room, and like you say, it was kind of all lit up and yet very, very quiet. It was like the dream was over, but I was still aware of the space, the seeming space, and it was very surreal. But I knew that this was a projection, and this was kind of a recap or a review of what had been projected, but there's no substance to it anymore. Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, like something came to you from outside of you. That was your actual, because nothing comes to you from outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I'm very clear that, you know, there's nothing. It doesn't matter what it appears I'm doing or thinking. I see how I'm the origin of it. It's an amazing thing. Because it's not only this concept, it's a reality for me.
Yeah, and that realization to me, you know, completely puts the kibosh on the victim script, which is what I think Ken Wapnick, you know, reminds us that every ego has a victim script, and the instant you bring it back inside and say, this is my awareness and has nothing to do with the seeming others, that, like Sophie, the other cat, our other cat who just walked in the room, I'm petting at the moment, that seeming other is a part, like you say, is a part of me. It's just an aspect of the greater self that appears to be a separate individual, just as I, you know, identify with because of the popularity of that approach that we've all kind of gotten into. I think that there's a separate individual called Bruce, and you think there's a separate individual called Lynn, and most of the time we behave that way. But like you say, every once in a while we have these epiphanies, appropriate for the season, or revelations that give us the awareness that this is just a massive projection. It's a massive hologram that's coming from the mind that we all share, but we've fashioned it through this crazy thought system called ego into seemingly separate selves. And it's like, what could have possessed us? I was actually listening to a folk song last night from Christine Lavin, who has this whimsical song about her attire mostly, but it's just, what was I thinking?
I've heard that song, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's just like, what could have possessed us? Well, in truth, you know, the gentleness of that humor is that nothing possessed us. We were basically motivated by nothing, which is what the ego is in truth, to make up a non-existent world, which is a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem. And seen from that light, it's just hilarious. I mean, it's just so silly. And I love that word that Ken uses, because it's not evil, sinful.
Silly.
It's just silly. It's just gently laughable. And we can appreciate each other and appreciate all the things that we as individuals seem to be going through, as well as all of our colleagues in the dream classroom here. And just have fun with it as we wake up to that awareness. So do you want to read the first thing?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So it's important to first to understand that when the Course says we have made up the world, it is not referring to the self we each believe we are, because that's the ego, with a specific body and brain and personality and name. These selves with which we are identified are only aspects of the world that we have made up. That is, they are effects and not causes. And the way I see it is like the furniture. You know, this body is part of the furniture. Mm-hmm. This personality is part of the furniture. It's part of the decoration. It's part of the texture of this imaginary world.
Yeah. Just another prop in the dream, huh?
Just a prop, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's those props that are set up to, that we set up to make it appear real, to make it appear believable, like the Matrix. It has to have that amount of density, or else it wouldn't appear real. It would appear like a cartoon. Although, I also think that were we to have a different sort of mindset that the world we would see would be like a cartoon. Mm-hmm. It's because the
very photorealistic one, but a cartoon.
Yeah. The reality that we've made up, that we give it, is the what it is. It has nothing to do with the object or the scenario itself. It has to do with our desire to believe that it's real. And the world could look like anything. And I don't know, and you don't know what the world looks like to me. I don't know what the world looks like to you. You could be living in a world where things were cartoonish, or people were, squares and circles, or, we could all be living in a world where our perception wasn't completely different than anyone else's perception. And we just notice, we just only see it our way and don't believe that the other ways are real, which is another thing. I don't want to go into this too much, but what I've noticed is that people, characters that I don't like, even though I made them up, if I don't like them, I don't see their world as being as real or compelling as mine is. I don't see their motivations as being as real or compelling as mine is. I see everyone else's world as sort of a cartoon. You know, I think, you know, when you complain that you're just being a baby, I think that, I don't see I don't have any kind of compassion for what I don't perceive as being true or real. And even though it may seem like I think that you're real, there's a big part of me that says, you're not as real as me. Your needs are not as important as mine. Your story is not as good as mine. You know, the whole point of making others is to make others be less, but to be a reflector to us of whatever it is that we particularly think at this moment. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of reality is it's really slippery when you start questioning, is this real or is that? Is this person or is that? You know, when you start looking at it that way, you recognize that I have no basis to know. There's no way from this ego state of mind that I can know in any way at all what is real.
I can
only imagine.
Exactly. And I think that's the power and the profundity, particularly those early workbook lessons of A Course in Miracles, that remind us that we have ascribed every little scrap of meaning to these dream characters and dream figures. And it doesn't start out talking about it as dreams, but that's the metaphor that's introduced later on, that we realize, my gosh, this is a massive, incredibly photorealistic, very believable, because our minds are so powerful, dream. It's just a projection. It's just an animated, I was thinking when you mentioned geometric things like circles and squares, it kind of reminded me that when you go to the theater and see computer-generated imagery, a lot of that is done through meshes of super fine triangles that are done so that the computing effort is minimized. But they basically take, landscapes. So they started out with doing things like mountains with, snowscapes and clouds and things like that. Well, a mutual friend of ours, Dave Van Dyke, does a lot of ray trace. I've dabbled with it a little bit myself, but he's a wizard at it, animations and one man band compared to these movies where you see the list of names and the special effects scroll past for quite a few minutes, hundreds or thousands, it seems like, of people have contributed to some of these really CGI intensive films. But you realize that, okay, all those are is just pixels, that basically each of those little triangles that has a different color that make up an image of a mountain or whatever, in a computer generated movie, resolves down to just little points of light, and that light isn't the light that, of course, in Miracles talks about. It's ego's made up light of differences. The light that, like you were talking about in your dream, where it's this dark place with a little spotlight that seems to pinpoint specific things. Well, that's our individuality. That's the little, you know, flashlight, or a little, you know, candle wannabe, really, in this incredibly bright universe. But we've had this dream of being in a darkened room, and so that little candle seems to have extraordinary and disproportionate importance, because we think that, well, this is my dream, and everyone else, like you say, everyone else's dream couldn't be possibly as important as mine, and that's where the ego gets into such meaningless distortions and distractions and diversions. Huh?
Yeah, and it's so interesting because when you start seeing it that way, or when I started seeing it that way, what I first I was seeing was that there's some people who are real and other people who are not. I honestly
thought. Somehow it reminds me of the kennel ration commercial years ago when you know, my dog's better because he eats kennel ration. My dream's better because it has, you know, better special effects or whatever. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, who are the real people and, you know, who are the fake people, or who are the, you know, you do kind of get into it. It gets kind of trippy. But anyway, let me finish reading this.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
So, all right, I'm going to start from the beginning, okay? And I guess, you know, you're right. These first lessons, I've been doing the lessons again this year. And by God, you know, if I had ever known when I first read Nothing I See Here Means Anything, the truth and reality of that if it means something, I made it up. And if I see something, it's an image that I made up, that these are all just thoughts that are just images. You know, this is like the deepest teachings in the world can know about what reality is. And, you know, they're just so simple. And, you know, just practice this for a while. You know, just practice seeing that what you think you see is not really true. It's really there at all.
Right.
It shifts you. It shifts you.
It does. So, it's kind of like watching one of the Matrix movies and realizing, wow, this really is this massively sophisticated projection. It's a moving hologram with special effects way beyond anything that any Hollywood studio or a couple of our newly again neighbors and friends that live up the hill from us are going to come over tomorrow night and watch the Golden Globes. And I was thinking about that when we started talking about projection, and they get these incredible efforts and performances that we all deliver for the movies that we call our lives, but we forget that when we watch an award show like that, that's true not just of what Hollywood and now CGI and you know, movie studios around the world put together, but we are doing that with our minds 24/7, 365, and yes. There are over 7 billion humans alone that have this movie studio going 24/7, 365, and they interact in such sophisticated and elaborate ways that, boy, it's a convincing dream here that we think we're in, but it's a dream. It's a mess.
Yes. Well, and also I think, you know, and just, you know, going back, you know, because before I was a whatever I am now, I was a biologist and I was a scientist and I did, you know, study these things. And, one of the things that really impressed me and now truly impresses me is that, you know, for instance, this Earth, which is the only thing that we really know, and actually really none of the rest of it actually even exists. Even this doesn't, but the world itself, that came from, you know, maybe a ball of flaming, carbon and whatever that was, you know, thrown out into space from the Big Bang, you know, if you adhere to that belief cooled and all these different things happen. And now we have, mountains and oceans and all that kind of stuff. But before
all those
fractals, yes. Before that, when we were first, the first life, which was still us, you know, the one-celled animals, the very first beings that even lived on this planet, it's kind of mixing things up, but the very first beings that lived on this planet were us. The only beings that have ever lived on this planet is us. That the sonship is the sum of all creation. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that we were one-celled animals. We became two-celled animals. We became, we were amoeba, and we became this, and we became that, and we became this, and over, you know, billions of years of evolution, you know, went from that to being these walking, talking monkeys here, but the same mind. It's been the same mind all the time.
Same primitive mind that says me amoeba. You are Yuba.
Yes, me and me, you are Yuba, exactly. And that same mind, though, in order to continue to be convinced of the reality of this illusion, has to make it more and more and more elaborate, more and more. I mean, this is why we're discovering more and more and more in space. This is why we're able to go and find, you know, planets and quasars and galaxies. And I mean, we will study infinitely and find everywhere we look what we're projecting. Our projection has become more and more and more elaborate, because in order to really continue to believe it, we have to beef it up. You know, it can't just be single one-celled animals, you know, swimming around in the ocean. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have to make it more complex.
Exactly. And what you're describing reminds me of some of the writings of Gary Renard's teachers, Artna Persa, who describe how, you know, the ego is based on division and the whole notion of, you know, if you look at cellular biology and, you know, from monocellular to multicellular, that whole idea, and then genetics, and then, you know, the whole basis of what we think we call biological life, which is really, you know, a parody of real life that of Course in Miracles addresses, that we all share. But because it's so sophisticated, because we can analyze it, study it, and have the technology to look, you know, deep inside the cell and the DNA and out into space, and, you know, it makes it even more real, like you're saying, you know, that we've got all this stuff now that a century or two ago we didn't have, to probe the depths of the dream. But we don't think of that when we're probing that and thinking, well, gee, this is just a really further strategy of the ego ultimately to distract us, to make the dream seem real. And that's
exactly, that's, we think we're discovering things.
Right, right.
We don't recognize that we're projecting more and more and more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
Every discovery we make is just a continued and more elaborate projection. And, you know, it's amazing how clever the ego is. But remember, and this is my own take on it anyway, the purpose of the ego is to make the illusion believable.
Mm-hmm.
It's to keep the illusion operating, keep it going. And as long as it keeps it as more, you know, the minute we start to, you know, maybe question, something else comes up. We get a new concept. We get a new scientific discovery, you know, and all of those things are the only purpose of them. If you believe that the whole purpose of the earth is for, or the world is to keep the ego going, the only purpose of it is not to discover the truth and reality of what we are.
Right.
The only purpose of it is to keep the ego, keep the illusion in place.
Uh-huh.
So
what if we classify a few more thousand planets in our, you know, scientific technology that could be habitable if we, you know, messed up this world bad enough? We're still going to have the same ego fundamentals to deal with, even if we, you know, use an incredible technological means to flee to another, escape planet. It's like, well, okay, but why? And I think the biggest why that is never examined that Ken Wapnick brilliantly addresses is that, and he suggests that, you know, that modern physics has done a lot to suggest that mind is primary, but the one aspect of mind that with the Copenhagen interpretation and things like that and the quantum entanglement that hasn't been addressed is the underlying unconscious guilt, because that's something science wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. So it'll probably be the last unanswered or unasked question of science.
Yes. Well, because that doesn't even seem to be a factor. That's what it is. We've moved so far from the reality that guilt doesn't seem to be a factor. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything. And yet it is the primary purpose beyond for which these things are being done, because, we're trying to have a better life, make a better life, and to live a better life, and to have, you know, we can extend out into the stars. What will we discover? We're going to give, you know, new possibilities. But every single discovery that we make comes with a whole nother set of, guess what, problems for us to solve.
Exactly. You nailed it, Lynn. And it's just another aspect of, you know, being recovering dream repair technicians but we forget that we're in that mode when we go merrily on our way about the day, during the day, you know, with our endless to-do list. I certainly account for that in my own mind, is, you know, just watching those processes and trying to, you know, essentially manipulate the dream. And if, you know, we don't think we're manipulators of the dream, even if we're, you know, a type B person, we're still trying to make the dream different. You know, it's still a constant activity of the ego mind to try to change what's on the screen, rather than to actually look at the projector and say, oh, well, gee, maybe I can address it at a different level, you know, like that sense. Should I read the next paragraph?
I haven't finished this.
Oh, you haven't finished? Oh, okay. Well, let's reach point.
This is just rich stuff here.
It is.
Okay, so I'm just going to start. It is important first to understand that when the Course says we have made up the world, it is not referring to the self we each believe we are, with a specific body and brain and personality and name. These selves with which we are identified are only aspects of the world we have made up. That is, they are effects and not causes. Jesus is only ever addressing us as mind, and it is the mind that has made all this up, as you have noted. The mind exists outside of time and space, that is, outside this world in which we seem to experience ourselves. And more accurately, it can be said that the world of time and space exists as an illusion within the mind. So this is where we go. It exists outside of time and space, the mind does, but within the mind is everything. And, I forget the philosophy, it's ancient philosophy, that says, you know, basically I exist and that's the only thing I know, and everything else is just a thought in my mind. And therefore, you know, as far as, and it's true, that's the only thing I can really know. It's the only thing you can really know. You can think, oh, there's a computer in front of me, but you only know that because it's in your mind. If it wasn't already in your mind, you wouldn't know what that was. You wouldn't know anything about it. It would have a caveman would see this and say, you know, rock, or, you know, whatever, because they have no notion of it. This is all here because it's in my mind. And
I was laughing only a moment ago because when you said in front of me, it kind of reminded me of a fun pun from W.C. Fields, who said, I'd rather have a frontal lobotomy a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. And
yes.
But then I was thinking, well, in our case, the bottle could be our computer screens or any other, you know, it doesn't have to be technological, but any other device or mechanism that, perpetuates the illusion of separation. But it's not the form that does it, it's the decision in the mind that does that. And I think that's where it's really important to,
exactly,
to look back to the mind again, as this paragraph you just read suggests, at the contents of the mind.
It appears to have a purpose.
Yeah. So did we finish that first part?
We finished that first part.
Okay. So I'll read the next one then. A useful analogy to help grasp this is to think of our dreams at night. While we are asleep, we typically think we are one of the figures we are dreaming about, usually the same self we are identified with when we are awake. But as we reflect upon a dream after awakening, we do not attribute any causal power to the figure in the dream with which we are, with which we identified, even though it may have seemed as if it had some control over events while we were still asleep. We know the dream and all the figures are merely symbols, results of our mind's imaginings. Jesus tells us in the basis of dream, from chapter 18, that the same mind that makes up and projects the world of our night dreams is also dreaming the world as we experience when we believe we are awake. Big clue there, huh?
Yeah, yeah, a big clue.
Night dreams and our daytime dreams are the same, just the form is different, but the content's the same.
Yeah, and I've experienced that, and I think you have too. Mm-hmm. I don't do lucid dreaming. I've never been able to do lucid dreaming, and you know, I know people talk about it, and they, you know, truly enjoy their experiences in it. But every time, Bruce, every single time in a dream, when I am sleeping, when I recognize that I am in a dream and I am sleeping, I wake up.
Uh-huh.
I'm never able to stay sleeping and dreaming and do anything in the dream.
Well, that actually could be a very helpful thing. Yeah. I mean, if we did that during our so-called daytime dreams, we wouldn't need this curriculum.
Exactly.
So that's a good reminder. Yeah, and I think that's what you just described is, to me, is the basis of what's called lucid dreaming, is being aware that you're dreaming while you're dreaming. But it's I think the important thing is, well, what is that awareness? And that's the self, and that is the mind that A Course in Miracles addresses, and only that awareness, because it's basically suggesting that anything that seems to be outside of us is just a massive illusion.
Yeah. And, you know, I do envy people who can lose a dream and who can, you know, I was dreaming and I recognized I was dreaming, so I decided to fly or I decided to do this. There's no decisions for me. Once I recognize I'm dreaming, the only decision I have is I got to wake up. This is not.
Yeah. Well, I've had a handful of lucid dreams in my life, and you know, whether it's more or less than average, I don't know. But to me, the take home lesson is that they're all the same. There's no difference between a lucid dream and a non lucid dream in one sense. And I kind of compare that to years ago when I had this. I'm going to use this dream in a different context. This dream of going to Egypt and going inside the Great Pyramid. And that started in high school when I started reading about this amazing structure. And I could spend an hour just talking about that, which has amazing mathematics and properties and whatnot. But when I finally got there and had a sort of mystical experiences in what's called the King's Chamber and what's called the sarcophagus, not that either of those are probably accurate terms. I call it the granite box in the uppermost chamber. And then I realized, well, I could have that experience anywhere. And the same thing, realization happened when I was using a biofeedback machine years ago. It's like, oh, I found where I could choose a mental state that emphasized alpha waves. And then I realized, oh, I don't need the machine to do that. And maybe in my mind that was a catalyst for achieving that because of my belief system. But then I realized, well, that's just only because of my belief system, and I could have chosen that at any time. So there's nothing wrong with the magic of you know, places or technologies or whatever, you know, whether it's medical or electronic or whatever. I mean, we believe we're here, so there's nothing wrong with using those things. And ultimately, we'll remember that it's the mind that makes that up and the mind that ascribes those capabilities to those technologies. So, and to those places, in the case of the trip to Egypt. So it really doesn't matter what the form is that we think we need. If we use that with our inner kindness teacher's promptings and our, you know, our Holy Spirit's curriculum to wake up from the dream, then we're following the curriculum. We're using our forgiveness classroom to forgive ourselves for thinking that specifics were the goal, and then we realize that the goal is to generalize and to see the innocence not just in one little isolated place that we think of as ourselves, but in everyone and everything. And that gentle awareness helps us wake up.
Exactly. It's that gentle awareness of that, you know, all, nothing I see here means anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I think that it means something, go to lesson number two. I gave it the meaning.
That's one of my favorite lessons. You nailed it. I've given everything I see on this room, in this street, in this place, all the meaning it has for me. Bingo. That's it, huh?
That's it. Once you hit that, you know, where else can you go? You know, you can't go into victimhood. You can't go into blaming or shaming. You know, you can't go into anything. You can only go to your own mind and say, I did this.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of lessons later where it says, these thoughts are like the stuff I see on this room, in this place, in this street. Because basically it's encouraging, even early on in this workbook, you know, start thinking about how the characters and the actors that make up your dream drama, your movie script, are projections and reflections of choices in the mind that we've all made on some unconscious level, but we can bring that into consciousness. And the choice that, of course, wants us to look at is the choice for the thought system of unconscious guilt, fear, sin, death, all that craziness of the birth, for that matter. I mean, the whole idea, like we were talking about earlier, the, you know, the cellular biology and fragmentation and countless divisions through divisions of cells within one body or divisions of cells, you know, sexually into other bodies, you know, and but what a massive misinterpretation of the oneness.
No, yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, you're making me think now too about, you know, my daughter is pregnant. My oldest daughter is pregnant again, and, baby is due in August.
Uh-huh.
So it's just itty bitty thing right now. And we were talking about it the other day, and she was saying, cause she has an app on her phone now that shows her, you know, how big this baby is or what, you know, it was like the size of a grain of rice, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And we were talking about that and the thought had come about when she first discovered she was pregnant, not from me, but from other people, was that, you know, she should have an abortion. She's 40. She's already got, you know, two kids, and her youngest is, you know, three. He'll be four in August. You know, she doesn't need to have another baby. She's not in a situation where it's a good thing. And, so, you know, people were saying, well, you know, maybe you should just go and, you know, have an abortion. And of course, you know, she doesn't think in that way at all. And actually, neither do I. Even though I, you know, I know, you know, all these things, I still look at that little thing that's the size of a grain of rice that is, you know, like billions of times bigger than it was when it was first conceived,
uh-huh.
You know, and to look at that and say, it's a person, you know, what is your definition of what a person is? And
uh-huh. if personhood is ultimately a joke that we can be very gently amused by, we can also apply that to, like, my friend and colleague Nassim Haramein says, well, we think three dimensions is real, but we're told in our math classes, you know, where he got into this in his line of reasoning. He says, we're told that one dimension, a line, or two dimensions of planar stuff isn't real, and dimensions higher than three aren't real. They're only, you know, mathematical conceptualizations, but three dimensions is real, you know. Well, why should three be special? You know, so it's the kind of thing with, you know, the biology, you know, why should, you know, a certain point in a process of you know, gestation magically bestow selfhood? Well, maybe the whole idea of birth and death could be brought into question as the basis of selfhood. If the self that we're talking about comes and goes, how could that be true? How could that be real if truth doesn't change?
Exactly.
How can anything that comes and goes be real or true?
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, that's the way I see it. And I don't see it as a moral issue,
no,
you know,
no.
to kill a person. That is not a moral issue to me. If killing a person was a moral issue to me, then I would be protesting every government in the world. I'd be protesting every police department. I'd be protesting, you know, I'd be having a moral issue with anybody who does or would or can ever actually kill another person, body. If I thought that that was true and real, then I would be a mess. I couldn't live with myself, and I don't think anyone could if that was their thinking. But the fact is that we all have our own little conceptions of things. And so, you know, a soldier, you know, across the world who is, you know, doing this or that or the other thing and people are being killed, you know, that doesn't affect me. So I don't see it as murder. But, you know, if my daughter went and had an abortion, that would be horrible. Even though, you know, what is the difference? Really, what is the difference? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not advocating murder. I'm just saying that, it's all a part of the story and it's all a part of the dream and it's all a part of, you know, what I perceive as being real and true. So if I perceive, you know, anybody, any life, any being in this universe as being real, then I've completely negated my own reality. I've completely negated the truth of what we are, because the minute you assign reality to anything in a dream, you've become the dream. You know, basically,
right.
You think you are the dream.
Yep.
So.
As you're saying that, I was thinking of a thought I had the other day while I was walking into town to get the mail about the word seduction. And I was thinking, well, normally that's used in the context of typically the stereotype, at least for me having grown up in a culture that is only now accepting gender, same gender, same sex relationships as being equally valid. But the typical application would be a heterosexual engagement in, for the purpose of something that has a negative outcome. I mean, if you think about something that is seductive, it's usually implying that there's something not so good going to happen as a result of that.
Yeah.
But I think that's actually a really helpful word to describe the ego strategy of trying to keep us mindless. And certainly issues in the world, again, compassion is always helpful. But first and foremost for our minds because the pain that we experience is not as I was listening to one of the Foundation for A Course in Miracles audios the other day that Jeff Siebert was talking about how reminding that, you know, pain is a mental process and Gary Renard's teachers have shared that too. You know, it's not a physical process; it's a mental process.
Yes.
And so all those issues of things like genocide and abortions and those kind of things are become very seductive topics that become so easy for people to get wrapped around the axle and think that that's where we need to focus the attention and. On the level of form, sure, why don't we do the things that are compassionate and if that's part of your activism that you feel drawn to express as a result of finding that inner peace, why wouldn't we do those things? But at the same time, if we can remember, the chew gum and walk approach to looking at the world while we're mindfully realizing it's a projection, that's where we can really be helpful. Ironically, is when we're not invested in the outcome, and is when we can really make the most difference.
Exactly. And to be not invested in the outcome really is exactly what this course is teaching us.
Mm-hmm.
It's to recognize that the outcome has no meaning and that that there is no outcome. That what we are seeing and perceiving and giving meaning to is actually coming from our own minds. It's our own thinking. So this is what we're talking about. And It's interesting you started talking about gender and stuff, and you were mentioning about the Matrix, and something I think is really fascinating in this world, in this ego world, is that both of the brothers who made the Matrix movies and who've made some amazing, amazing movies that expanded or showed us that, you know, what we think is real is not. Both of those brothers are now sisters.
Oh, really?
Yes. They both did sex change operation. I think a big part of the reason that they were making the movies was to get the money to be able to do that. So, so it was women who made the Matrix.
Which interestingly, etymologically, that Matrix is another word for womb. And I used to work on audio and video matrices for the broadcast industry. And in fact, I worked on a system that I got to coin the name Cheshire, which I like the idea of, you know, the Cheshire cat looking over the chessboard in Alice in Wonderland, and the chessboard being sort of a matrix of squares. And gently smiling at the, you know, above the battleground of thinking that the important thing is what cross point is connected to, you know, what signal is going where in the world. Well, actually the real, you know, as A Course in Miracles would suggest, the real choice is, you know, what thought system. That's the real alternative, which is a binary choice. It's we're either using the nothingness of the ego or the everythingness of the Holy Spirit's curriculum that leads us gently back to that awareness that we've never left. Perfectly.
Interesting. Yeah, Cheshire. Yeah. I like it. And the Cheshire cat is such a great symbol because, you know, he smiles and disappears. Mm-hmm. And all that's left is the grin. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Our local Cheshire cat is climbing on the printer right now. And saying,
all right.
Oh, isn't it time for breakfast? It must be time for breakfast.
No, it's not for another half hour. Okay, so I'm going to go on ahead and read.
Okay.
We experience ourselves as separate minds, but we are in fact part of the one mind, both the single ego mind that is dreaming the world we experience as outside ourselves, and the one mind with a capital M that knows nothing of illusion. Although the how of this whole process of projecting a world is interesting, the more important question from the Course's perspective is why? Why do we do it? As Jesus observes later in the same section, is it not strange? I love the way Jesus talks, isn't it? He asks questions. I love it that Jesus asks questions. He doesn't make so much statements.
Yeah.
Is it not strange that dreams can make a world that is unreal? It is the wish to make it. I'm sorry. He's saying not is it. He says it is not strange. I'm sorry. It is not strange that dreams can make a world that is unreal. It is the wish to make it that is incredible. So the whole idea that we want to make a world that's unreal is incredible, which
Why?
Means not believable, unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And the wish comes from the insane desire to be something other than who we are as God has created us. And the guilt that follows from that desire, which we seek to project and see outside ourselves. Earlier in the text, Jesus observes that, quote, the world you see is the delusional system of those made mad by guilt, unquote. That's chapter 13. And he means that quite literally, the world is nothing more than our own guilt as the one sleeping sun projected outward, identical in process to the nightmares that we may experience while we sleep at night, which come from what we experience as our own personal internalized guilt, but they are all the same, and they are insane, for we are doing nothing to undo the guilt within our minds, but rather are denying its source, preferring to see the guilt outside rather than within. So even me talking to you, looking at anything, everything that I see and experience is actually a desire for me to project my guilt for having run away from home and betrayed God. It's I can't stand it inside of me, and so I project it out, and I see the guilt in you. I see the guilt in the kitty. I see the guilt in, I become the victim of everything. Because as much as I love you and as much as I love the kitty, you know, somehow or the other, I'm going to have to do something to keep you satisfied. I'm going to have to feed the kitty, obviously, because, you know, he's going to come bugging me until it happens. You know, all of these things are forcing me to take action and to be and to do in the world. And the only purpose of it is to calm the guilt. So, you know, once you fed that kitty, you're going to feel better, you know, until the next time the kitty wants to be fed. You know, it really is just a way of trying to overcome or calm that guilt within ourselves so that we can be at peace. But we'll never be at peace because that kitty is always going to be hungry again. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll never be at peace as long as the solution that you come up with is not a whole and permanent solution. As long as the problem continues to exist, these solutions are just band-aids that we're putting on the, it is a maladaptive solution to a, what is it, problem? To a non-existent problem.
Yeah.
You know, you know, unfortunately, we just make more and more and more and more and more problems. You know, when we live in the world and we project out in the world, we make more. Now that we're global and we know what's going on in Syria, we know what's going on in Aleppo, we know what's going on in Russia. You know, now there's even more for me to feel guilty about. You know, I could have gone to my little mountain home and just sat there without the internet and been in happy bliss, thinking that, you know, I was in peace. And but I couldn't, because I would always know that there are other people out there suffering. No matter how much peace I find, no matter how much joy I find, I always know that there are other people suffering, because I'm projecting that in the world. I cannot be content with any solution, because it's not a solution. It's just a Band-Aid on the problem.
Right, right. There's a movie that addresses that. You can talk about, you know, retreating to a remote existence, which kind of reminds me of a certain family situation, which will go nameless at the moment. But there's a movie called Captain Fantastic, and it raises some interesting questions. And these people that live out in the boonies have to confront. And in this case, symbolically, they do that by returning to the rest of their tribe, if you will, their family. And because of a family situation, but it raises some very interesting questions about the nature of how we think we can kind of go off and do this John Wayne thing of, well, I'll do it myself, I'll kind of be this pioneer, and sometimes we do it very literally, thinking we can go off in a cave and meditate or live off the land and be self sufficient. Well, I like kind of reminded of and one of the things that Gary Renard likes to mention is that, Jesus wasn't the greatest leader. He was the greatest follower, the ultimate follower. And I think that's really a position where, if we recognize that our individual way, our John Wayne, I'll do it myself kind of, approach hasn't worked, we realize that being led by that voice for compassion and kindness and gentleness is really the way out of that. And that's our forgiveness teacher.
Yeah, exactly. Because once we recognize that the compassion that I feel for you and the way that I treat you and the way that I give love to you is reflective of the way that I am compassionate to myself.
Exactly.
And this is one of the reasons I think that the Course is so brilliant, is that Jesus points out to us that whatever we do to another, we're doing to ourselves. Whatever we think about another, we're thinking about ourselves. That wherever we go, whatever we see, whatever we experience is a projection of our own thinking. And it brings it back to the source. You know, we come back to the source of the problem. And once, I recognize and I have owned up to the source of the problem, then I can change. And when I change, the world I see changes. It's not because it becomes a fantasy and I start making up stories about how it could, how I think it's better now. It's because it literally actually does change. Because the dream experience is our wish.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's whatever I wish to see is what I'm going to see.
That's and the motivation again, the why.
Yeah, not going into denial about what I'm seeing now, just recognizing that I'm seeing it because I want to see it. Mm-hmm. And if I change my mind and I don't want to see it anymore, I don't hide from it. I change my mind so that I recognize that it can't possibly be. And when I recognize that it can't possibly be, I see the truth behind it. I see that the people who appear to be suffering are all just the same as me. You know, if there are other people, they're doing the same thing I'm doing, trying to learn, trying to cope, trying to grow. And if my experience happens to be that I develop cancer or I break my leg or, you know, I get, you know, kidnapped and tortured and murdered or any of those things, that's the experience I came here for. It's not your fault. It's not anybody else's fault. There's no victiming going on here. It's just I'm experiencing what I came here for. But it's really hard.
Of course, we wouldn't wish those experiences on anyone in the sense that, you know, we don't want anyone to suffer. And I think that it's important to remember that there's nothing in A Course in Miracles that suggests that, you know, we do anything to further or increase the fear or the suffering or the anxiety. And
in fact, just the opposite.
Just the opposite, yeah. But it's only by looking at the contents of our mind do we see that the world we see is a delusional system of those made mad by guilt. And then that then is our way out of the nightmare.
Right. And actually, you can actually become, I think, very effective in comforting, in bringing love, bringing light to the world, when you recognize that it's your responsibility to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's my responsibility to have a peaceful life, to be a peaceful person, to allow the Holy Spirit to inform me about situations, to guide me in situations. That's my responsibility. And if I am following along and doing what the Holy Spirit is giving me, then I'm not going to be in pain. I'm not going to see suffering. I'm going to see fully responsible beings who are me living a life that we've chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, I'm not saying turn your back on people who are in trouble, because obviously if you're seeing that, it's because you've chosen that. And, you know, if I chose suffering, then I'm responsible for changing my mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, to see that it's not there. But always to recognize it's always my choice.
Yeah.
And when I recognize it's my choice, I can act in a more effective way, not just running around, you know, screaming and pointing out the ills, but actually being able to be of comfort to people, to actually be able to send love to people, to have that forgiveness in my mind that actually changes or shifts their situation. But that's my take on it. So, okay. I knew you would, because you're a agreeable guy. So you want to go ahead with the next paragraph?
Sure. Each seemingly separate fragment of mind, believing it is separate, does not have the power to change the one ego mind's dream in any meaningful way. But it does have the power to learn to look at the dream differently, until eventually it gives no power to the dream and awakens from it. I was hearkening back to that song lyric of Katie Lang of constant craving, you know, the seduction of the ego. And the lyric goes, you know, constant craving has always been. It just flashed in my mind. I was listening to some music lately, and it's somehow the lyrics sometimes have little clues, you know, if we want to use them for that purpose. But then the always of the ego is time-based. So, in other words, seeing that as it is, you know, there's nothing in the ego's strategy that can't be undone by however seemingly, you know, well rehearsed and well learned by you know, anything that the ego seems to have mastered can be unmastered by the awareness that supersedes and transcends the ego's battlefield. And that is, of course, the awareness of the Holy Spirit, a.k.a. our inner kindness teacher, or Jesus of the Course, that gives us the opportunity to look at each specific and learn to generalize and see that that's an opportunity to see things differently. Yeah. Okay, so let me go on. But it does have the power to learn to look at the dream differently until eventually it gives no power to the dream and awakens from it. It is in this sense that we can say that we are each completely responsible for the world we see and experience. And that's responsible for which choice of teacher we invite into our mind to interpret or translate it with. Huh? We each make up our own psychological world based on our interpretation of what we seem to be experiencing. It is still the mind outside of time and space that is interpreting the experience, but we seem to have a choice about how we will look at what seems to be happening around us and to us, and what we experience, and what we ourselves, and what we ourselves as figures in the dream are doing. And the only real choice is to which teacher in our minds we turn to help us interpret our experiences, the ego or the Holy Spirit. This is the more practical level on which the Course is written. For knowing the metaphysical basis of our world helps us begin to question our ego interpretations of events, which up until now we were certain were true. Yeah, we thought this dream was the real deal. After all, it's photorealistic and three-dimensional, and it's got you know, biology and astronomy and microscopy and all kinds of other fancy
and whatever else we need to invent to make it seem real, as we notice that those are not real.
Exactly.
We're like, well, that's not real, so we better make up something new.
Mm-hmm. Constant cravings of diversions. And
I just looked up the lyrics to that song. That's an amazing song.
Yeah.
I never really listened to the lyrics to that song before, but she describes our state exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's so much in art and literature and you know, the arts in general that really, if you're looking for it, give wonderful descriptions of the maladaptive solution of the non-existent problem. And that's why I think, you know, again, Ken so rightly says we can use anything and everything, all the specifics to generalize, and why not use the music and the movies and the media that we quote unquote consume, which really is just a reflection being fed back to us of a decision in the mind, to use as our undoing classroom. If you want to send me the link to that lyric, and I'll post that as part of the
I'll do that. I'll find a video with the lyrics.
Oh, okay, great.
Because it's really, I'm just going to read them real quick,
sure,
if you don't mind.
Oh,
I know we're here. Okay. It's A Constant Craving. It's a song by Katie Lang. And it says, even through the darkest phase, be it thick or thin, always someone marches brave here beneath my skin. And constant craving has always been. Maybe a great magnet pulls all souls to what's true, or maybe it is life itself that feeds wisdom to its youth. Constant craving has always been. And that's the lyrics, and then all the rest of it is just constant craving has always been. So really about whatever it is that we think is going on, that constant craving is like, you know, beneath our skin. It's you know, pulling us but what it's really pulling us to is, like she says, maybe a great magnet pulls all souls to what's true.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe it's life itself that feeds wisdom to its youth. But whatever it is, it's that craving that brings us to it. Very good. Interesting.
It is. I think that's, thank you for bringing that up and sharing the rest of the lyric, because I'd forgotten the other, how cool it was. Because again, it really is just a reminder there's two thought systems. And that one that is that sort of the magnetic one that we're all drawn to is the one that says, I can look at my victim script and my dissatisfaction with the world and all the things that I'm upset over, whether it's a health condition or a financial condition or a global condition or, you know, yeah, familial or whatever. I mean, in any category or any specific can be thought of as, you know, a craving or a seduction or a, you know, a dream that basically is trying to keep us mindless. But there's always that teacher that you know, we're always drawn to that says, there's another way of looking at the world. I could choose to see things differently. I can take this specific and turn it around, as Byron Katie suggests, and you know, see that there's not any truth in anything that changes, and really start to resonate with what doesn't change, and that becomes our lighthouse, our guiding post for you know, getting us through the storms of.
Excuse me. Exactly. I love that. All right. Well, go ahead and finish the paragraph.
Okay. Let's see. Where was I? I think I got about the middle of it there, right? Let me just start here. We each make up
from the beginning.
Okay. Well, I'll just start here with a few sentences in. We each make up our own psychological world based on our interpretation of what we seem to be experiencing. It is still the mind outside of time and space that is interpreting the experience, but we seem to have a choice about how we will look at what seems to be happening around us and to us, and what we ourselves as figures in the dream are doing. And the only real choice is to which teacher in our minds we turn to help us interpret our experiences, the ego, the Holy Spirit. This is the more practical level on which the Course is written. Okay. And I think I read that much. For knowing the metaphysical basis of our world helps us to begin to question our ego interpretations of events, which up till now we were certain were true. And we will begin to see that depending on to which teacher we turn to interpret what seems to be happening, we will have diametrically opposite experiences. And I'm going to pause right there just to share a metaphor that I found really helpful in the last year or three or whatever, is the director's cut. You know, when you watch a movie, a DVD, oftentimes will, if you throw in the DVD player and you can go to the setup menu, oftentimes there's an option to have the director's commentary, the audio track. So, you know, if you're really a fan of a particular film, you might want to watch a movie and then watch it again with the director's commentary to kind of get an idea of what was going through their minds when they made this up. Well, we I think by default have the ego's director's cut commentary on most of the time, and that audio track basically, you know, reinforces the victim script that says, oh, well, you know, because it wants us to be mindless. It basically, that's why it's maladaptive. It doesn't want to solve the problems. It wants to pretend that it's solving the problem and make itself.
And think about this. I don't want to cut you off here, but I'm cutting you off.
Go for
because
it.
Because what you're saying here, we will hear that over and over and over. Yeah, the ego wants to pretend this. Why? What is the ego's purpose for any of these things? The only purpose the ego has for any of these things is to continue to make the dream appear real.
Right.
To bolster the dream so that we continue to believe it. It's its job. When we made the ego, we said to it, here's your job. We're going to make up a world in which all kinds of crap's going to happen. We don't even know because, you know, that would make it not fun if you knew already. We're going to make up a world and all this crap's going to happen. And I'm going to forget that I did it. And you are going to make sure that I never remember. You are going to make sure that I can, because I can't enjoy or I can't experience the dream as real if I know it's a dream. So your job, ego, is to keep me in the dream. And if you have to invent molecular biology to do that, or if you have to invent deep space exploration to do that, go for it. Because whatever it is that needs to be made to keep me caught up in this, I still want to keep doing it. And you know, eventually I won't want to do it anymore. And then I'll kind of, you know, say, you've done a good job, go away. But until then, I'm depending on you, ego, to keep me fooled. Mm-hmm. So just know that you are doing it to yourself.
Yeah. Exactly. And we're doing it to ourselves by choosing one of those diametrically opposite experiences. And as the Course reminds us, only one of them is true. And we've chosen the one that is, that changes, because truth never changes. So, but there's nothing wrong with that. It just means that we've chosen nothing. And that's just silly. So we can afford to gently laugh at that choice and say, oh, yeah, that was kind of, you know, not beat ourselves up, but just say, oh, okay. Like, and in fact, it gives us tremendous compassion for ourselves and everyone else when we recognize that. It's like, well, why would anyone want to choose that? It's just silly. It's just, there's just no point in it.
Well, and also I just wanted to point out, too, that the world doesn't lose its beauty when stop believing in the reality of the dream. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. It actually becomes even more beautiful, mm-hmm. because then you can see it and not be afraid of it. You can see it without guilt.
Yep.
And guilt destroys all pleasure. It doesn't matter how much you love something or someone. Guilt is going to destroy the pleasure of it. If you don't see that there's no purpose, no reason for guilt, and let that go. And so that's the other thing is, you know we made it up. We know we're doing it to ourselves. We don't have to feel guilty about it, because the Holy Spirit will undo all the effects of that wrong decision if we let him.
Mm-hmm. All there is in my mind.
That's it. Let go. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
That's helpful. I think that's why I've enjoyed these conversations so much over the last year plus 2 years now, whatever it's been, because I think, you know, we kind of leverage off of what the other person has said, and we're coming from that perspective of realizing that we're undoing this, and I think it's sort of a microcosm of the fact that we're all helping each other, and that's where it takes the real courage, I think, is to look at the mind without judgment and without condemnation. And see that we're all in the same boat, and but then at some point the courage even becomes an irrelevant perspective, because how could seeing the truth in a pure non-dual reality take any, if there's nothing to be afraid of, where is courage needed, you know? So anyway, let me finish this okay. This paragraph, because I think we're getting close to the end here.
I think it's last, yeah.
Yeah, so I'll just say, for as Jesus notes near the end of the workbook in a lesson that begins by describing the process we've been discussing, by which the mind makes a world, and then he quotes, from insane wishes comes an insane world, from judgment comes a world condemned, and from forgiving thoughts a gentle world comes forth with mercy for the Holy Son of God, to offer him a kindly home where he can rest a while before he journeys on, and help his brothers walk ahead with him and find the way to heaven and to God. And I think that's our curriculum, isn't it? To look at our victim script and say, hey, I don't want this for myself, and I don't want it. Wouldn't wish that for anyone else. I mean, why would anyone want anyone else to suffer or to be miserable? You know, it's like, well, and the choice is always a mental choice.
Exactly.
But why not do the things that seem to help on the level of form? You know, like, you know, yesterday when I walked in town to get the mail, I got a little bottle of cough syrup and some cough drops for my wife, who's, you know, at the moment, you know, under the weather a little bit. So it was, and that felt good to be able to contribute that. So
exactly. This quote is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I posted it in the room, and I'm just reading it again, because this really just says everything that we just now said. Yeah. From insane wishes comes an insane world.
Yeah.
From judgment comes a world condemned. And from forgiving thoughts, a gentle world comes forth. It actually does shift the world, mm-hmm. with mercy for the Holy Son of God, to offer him a kindly home where he can rest a while before he journeys on, which also means that there's more to go. Once we get to this place where we've forgiven the world, mm-hmm. We come to a place where we rest, and that's, I think, what Jesus calls the real world, mm-hmm. And help his brothers walk ahead with him and find the way to heaven and to God. So again, it's that shared experience that comes about. You know, we cannot be healed alone. When I'm healed, I'm never healed alone. And it's the joining because the joining is actually the reflection, the recognition of the reflection. When I've forgiven you, what you reflect back to me is peace, is love, is joy, is the Holy Son of God himself. So that is the Christ. You are the Christ. When I have forgiven you all the things that I made up about you, all I see is the Christ. Mm-hmm. When I forgive the world of all the stories I made up about it, all I see is the Christ. And the world becomes a gentle place.
Exactly. That's alternative that the last chapter in the text suggests that we consider as having tried every permutation of the false alternative and found it lacking. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So what an incredible gift this is to us, to you and me together, because I know that this is not just, you know, two friends talking to each other. This really is a joining of the Holy Son of God and the Christ mind. And I'm sure that's, you know, there's some part of you that's saying, well, you know, I don't know about, but it's true. It is true. This decision to join has, I think, resulted in tremendous growth for me. I'll tell you what.
Me too. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Cause I always welcome these kind of opportunities, which now I have several per week that are, you know, kind of this level of conversation that remind me that I really could do this more and more rather than just, you know, now and then when I stumble across a little more mindful moment. but I think it starts to fill in the gaps to where sort of like those pictures of the planet where you've got a little, you know, hubs of metropolitan areas that are connected, and pretty soon they light up and then they spread out to, you know, the peripheral places. And but there's really no periphery. There's really just one thing, but it appears on the level of form where we think there's differences to, you know, start propagating from one seeming separate mind to another. And so that's a gentle awakening that we can use metaphorically, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Bruce, I don't see Devin in the room yet, but I'm hoping he's coming in here pretty quick. But anyway, thank you so much,
thank
Bruce.
You.
All.
Thank you, as always. Yeah.
It's been great. And off topic here, can you send me the way to get into the Weekend of Freedom Retreat website,
because
start making doing some work on it.
Okay, you betcha.
Because we're having a big conference, a big retreat in October. Let me just throw this in.
Oh, great!
In the beautiful, a beautiful place called the Art of Living Retreat in outside of Boone, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
And oh my gosh, this place is probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life, and I haven't been there yet. I'm just dying to get there. We're going to have Regina Dawn Akers, John Mark Stroud, Jennifer Hadley, Lori Coburn, and Maureen Muldoon. And then Donna Marie Carey is going to be our musical, guest. And, I'm just really looking forward to this. I think it's going to be just amazing.
That's in October, huh?
It's in October.
Great.
And, let me find the
I just found the website for the for the retreat center. Yeah.
Oh, for the retreat center. Okay, good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I'll give you I made a video. I'm going to put the link to the video in the room. People can go and watch that. And then also, I'll send you the link to the video, and it's got all the information about the retreat, and we're very, very excited about this. So I'm glad we have a few extra minutes to talk about it. Anyway, thank great, you again, Bruce Rawls.
Thank you, Lynn. And you can always reach me through ACIMblog.com and also on Facebook. I have a Facebook page about ACIM blog and also a personal one that I have. I share lots of puns and fun stuff. So
yes,
things I found amusing and interesting.
Bruce is fun to have as a Facebook friend because you get to see all kinds of cool stuff. And if you find something cool, you can send it to him and he'll enjoy it too.
I usually share a lot of those things. So.
Yeah, so it's awesome. So,
thanks,
all right, I just sent you the link to that video if you want to take a look at that. And
I will do that. Yeah.
All right, I love you, Bruce, and I so appreciate. In fact, you're in that video. You sleep on the couch. Not saying anything, but you're there. Go see yourself.
Cool.
Anyway, I love you, Bruce. I'll talk to you next week.
Great. Thanks so much, Lynn. Bye for now.
All right. Bye-bye.